the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Europe Code Week. Well, that's a bit of an enigma. Sorry, I couldn't resist it. But in terms of obviously the whole notion of coding and such like material, do you wish you'd learned to code at school? Do you actually have an understanding of the universal language of coding? Or maybe we'll actually find out over the next few moments when we've got two fabulous individuals to share their passion for Europe Code Week. Of course, first up, Maggie Philbin, OBE, TV presenter, Chief Executive Officer of Teen Tech. She is basically a Renaissance woman. Maggie, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much. Thank you for that introduction.
Absolutely right. And we've also got Ace, Apple developer, of course, and coder from his own point of view. That's Teo Omosore. How are you, Teo?
I am very well. Pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Teo, let's come to you first. What attracted you to coding in the first place? Because, you know, the notion of basically coding, it's just for geeks, basically. And then, of course, there's always the occasional Bill Gates who actually makes it more successful than other geeks and so on. What, from your own perspective, drew you to this field?
I think that's a great question. I think from my point of view, the thing that really attracted me to coding was the ability to have my ideas come to life using code, whether that be a game, a social media platform, me just wanting to try out my ideas, no matter how ludicrous they seem to be. I could write something down and then code it and then publish it onto the App Store. With so many resources available, it just makes it really accessible. And I think the fact that I could think of an idea, pull it on the App Store, and people from around the world at an instant with devices that we all carry could engage and enjoy it is just like something that still blows my mind to this day.
And Maggie, that's very much the heart of obviously Europe Code Week, but in essence, presumably your own work as CEO for Teen Tech, that, you know, as we've just heard there, this gives you such a tremendous opportunity. I mean, just looking at this 2022 report finding, digital literacy, if you improved it, it could provide, you know, a £41.5 billion boost. I mean, that's almost half of an HS2 line.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really powerful message, because young people growing up today, if you're a teenager, you're living in a very fast changing world. You're living in a digital world, and the opportunities, the real opportunities which are open to you, are very different to the ones that might have been open to your parents and certainly to your grandparents. And the beauty of Europe Code Week is the way it shines a light on, well, you know, if you learn how to code, there are all sorts of ways that you could bring your ideas to life. And, you know, we see this happening in Teen Tech, where if a young person really cares about an idea, so there was a girl who had had some very poor experiences in hospital, and that drove her to start to develop an app so that it was really easy, if a young teenager was in hospital, to be able to communicate quickly to all of the people looking after what her particular boundaries might be. Now, and there is actually quite, there's a research been done, which I think it's like 1 in 10 people believe there is an app in them. So this is an opportunity for people of whatever age to explore coding. There are very easy entry points, and starting with an idea is a really good way to do it. You know, for some people, they might want to, you know, go online. There are all sorts of resources available. And I mean, for instance, obviously, if you go on the Apple website, you'll be able to access resources, whether you're a teacher or a parent or a young person. Or, you know, some people prefer to learn in person. And again, Europe Code Week is there's an explosion of activities all over the UK. And I mean, if you go into an Apple Store, there are free workshops. So it's a great way to get started and to realize that this is not it's not a nerdy thing to do. It's a way of giving yourself another form of literacy. And, you know, some people will become amazing and brilliant programmers, but having that knowledge of how the technology is built is really useful.
Maggie just mentioned that 1 in 10 people have an app in them. Of course, you've just produced your 10th app. So that kind of reverses that on its head, really. That, is, of course, is MultiWords. You started back in 2014. That's pretty much an app a year. I mean, clearly, in terms of the development, Maggie makes it sound very easy, effortless from that point of view, which is great because that's the skill set that's around. But there are still folk who are quite frightened by this technology. I mean, we deal with computers. We're using a computer to communicate today. We're connecting with all sorts of things. Is it as easy for, shall we say, a complete novice to effectively say, yeah, I want to do some coding because I missed out. I was a baby boomer. I've never heard about this.
To be honest, I think I would say it is. But I think it's one of those things, the more that you put into it, the more that you get out of it. When I started in 2014 on my commute, I had 3 hours every single day to kill, and I really wanted to build something. I had an idea in my head to build a simple arcade game, something so simple that my parents, who are not gamers, could engage with. And talking to people on my commute, as the development cycle progressed, to ask them what they thought of the game, if the user interface and the user experience would be something that they would be interested in, was a fantastic experience, because a lot of people would ask me questions, you know, maybe a child that they had was interested in coding, where could they start? And I think when I told them my story about being in a job and being self-taught, it really kind of made it seem more accessible. I think it looks really difficult. You see a wall of code, loads of lines, but it does get easier. An example of this is you want to press a button and then a new screen to appear. It's very much written like English. So you say, if user presses button, then show new screen. So when you break it down, I think it becomes a lot more readable, understandable. And just kind of going on from that, my first app took 6 months to develop. And then I rewrote it 8 years later, and it took me a week, and I had a full-time job. So that was just evenings working on it. So you do get better, it gets easier, and it's such a fun experience.
Sounding good. Maggie, let's return back to your good self. Obviously, you're very committed to improving diversity in science, technology and engineering and so on. One might say without Ada Lovelace, we probably wouldn't have actually had any computing in the first place, really, with her excellent work back in the day. But you know, is this also something where we are getting much more balance in terms of genders? Because again, I mentioned about sort of the geek approach. It's often been seen as a male preserve as well, things like coding.
Things are changing. I would say they're not changing fast enough. And helping young people, you know, no matter what gender they are, no matter what their background might be, understand that this is a world that you can very much play a strong part in. And, you know, giving those young people opportunities to play with code, to understand that they can bring ideas to life, and also, quite frankly, sometimes giving them the opportunity to get it wrong, because in formal education, getting things wrong isn't always seen as a good option, but I think it's important to get things wrong. You know, that's where you learn from them, and in the real world, we all get things wrong. Watching the way and how tenacious young people can be when they get an idea, they absolutely want to turn it into reality, no matter how complicated it might be. And, you know, there's a lot of support out there, the support online, the support through various organizations. Again, you know, another, you know, group of people who I'll always remember were some lads in Brixton who had a great idea for an interactive comic that you could hold your phone over a comic, download a game. And, you know, we connected them with the CTO of a major tech company to help them understand how would you actually build that. And they turned that into reality. And that is incredibly satisfying. It's satisfying for the young people. It's incredibly satisfying for me to see that they're able to do that. because back in the day on Tomorrow's World, the people who were able to develop technology, for the most part, were either working in universities for large tech companies. You did have the odd sort of inventor in a shed, but that wasn't the norm. Well, things are different now, and it's so important that when we are developing ideas for our world, that those ideas are coming from everyone and not just from a very narrow band of society.
Maggie, I think you're arguing for the democratization of science, which is a whole other topic, but we'll talk about that at some future date. Now, Apple, obviously, behind this, we've already talked about the Apple stores and so on, and I'm sure that Steve Jobs will be looking down from on high, or whichever digital heaven he happens to be based in, saying, this is good, this is all fantastic. Where can people actually go to find out further information, please?
Well, if you can go on the Apple website to find out about all the various resources that are available. apple.com/today will give you information about what's happening in your local store. And of course, if you go on the Europe Code Week site, you will see all of the resources that are open to you. And these resources tend to be there year round. This week is a way to an opportunity to focus on it. But this work is going on all the time.
Maggie Philbin, OBE, TV presenter extraordinaire, Chief Executive Officer, Teen Tech, and so much more. We would just basically carry on forever, basically praising Maggie Philbin, the awesomeness that is there. Huge thanks. And likewise, Apple developer extraordinaire, Teo Almasore, huge thanks. Happy digital coding and happy Europe Code Work people, or Code Week people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wine. It's an important part of life. It's an important and celebratory part of the whole experience of being human in so many ways. But how much do you really know your wine? Well, we're delighted to welcome a master of wine to talk us through a whole range of things and why maybe buying a appropriate bottle of wine shouldn't be as stressful as we think it will be. It's master of wine, of course, Richard Bamfield. Richard, how are you?
I'm extremely well, thanks, Alex. It's nice to join you.
Excellent. Well, so, I mean, nearly half of UK adults have admitted they don't know how to identify a good bottle of wine from a bad bottle. And presumably you can't really taste it beforehand, so you try before you buy is not necessarily an option. So what are the challenges this research that's been developed has kind of shown us from Lidl?
I think it throws up lots of challenges. I think it does show that because it is difficult to know exactly what's in the bottle without tasting it. To my mind, it's not just whether it's good or bad. I think most wine is good. I've been in the wine business for 40 years now. And believe me, the average quality of wine is way better than it used to be. Technologically, we're improved. There are very few bad bottles of wine, I think. So it's not, to my mind, a question of whether it's good or bad. It's more a question of whether it's to your taste or not. And you'll know with food, just because you don't like a dish doesn't mean it's bad food or it's been badly cooked. It just means it's not to your taste. And it's just the same with wine. So the key thing, I think, is trying to understand your own palate and finding out what you like. So that's part of it, that it's difficult to know from the on the shelf whether the wine's going to appeal to you or not. And then once you have bought it, you know, there's unfortunately people get hung up about the rights and wrongs of how you should drink it, how you should serve it, what you should serve it with, all this sort of thing. It's complex.
Indeed. Now, as a master of wine, do you feel that this obsession with price actually is justified? You know, the notion that actually the more you pay, the better the wine should actually be, or is that a kind of urban myth?
No, I certainly don't think it's a myth. I mean, I think in all walks of life, it's a reasonable assumption that if you may pay more for a product or service, then you're paying for higher quality. I think that's totally reasonable. And with wine, you could argue that's true up to a certain point as well. I suppose with my Lidl hat on, you know, we see our job as trying to ensure that we've got wines at lower price points that are good wines, they're well made, and they taste like they're more expensive than they are. And so I don't think that you have to spend a lot of money for a wine. And obviously in the wine business as well, we have wine brands, particularly in the sparkling wine business. And, you know, whenever you're buying a brand, whether one likes it or not, you are paying a premium price for the brand so that they can build it and support it. And at Lidl, we like to think that we've got wines that are every bit as good as the more famous brands, but without the same price tag.
So let's go back to the top of this particular piece, Richard. How can we actually take the stress out of actually going to the supermarket and purchasing our next bottle of wine? If we're getting into Lidl, how can we actually reduce that stress element?
Okay, well, first off, I'm delighted you're going into a Lidl to reduce the stress, because that'll help. And it's also the supermarket I know best, for obvious reasons. So, and certainly at Lidl, we've got a section of the wines called the Wine Tour, which is in wooden crates. And those wines have tasting notes on them. They have an indication of how dry or sweet they are. They have an indication of what food or occasion they're likely to accompany best. And they also have a score out of 100, which is an indicator from us as to which wines we think are the highest quality. And it's useful, because the highest scoring wines aren't always the most expensive. And so it's a really good way, we think, of helping shoppers find genuine value for money. So use the cues that are there. We know that, you know, the label and the price are not necessarily an indicator of whether you're going to like the wine. And so use the other cues that are there, like the tour cards and anything else. Secondly, I know not everybody is as excited about wine as I am and reads books and wants to do research and all that sort of thing. But it is worthwhile trying to remember what you've enjoyed and what you haven't enjoyed so much in the past. So if you know that if you were with friends or you're in a restaurant or a bar and there was a bottle of wine where you thought, oh, gosh, that's really good, take a picture of it. Just take a picture so you've got a record of that. Try to remember the grape variety, the country it came from, maybe how old or young it was. And all of that will help you with your future choices. It's also worth remembering wines which you're less keen on as well, because that again will offer the help. And finally, if I'm permitted, come along to one of the Chateau Noir events that Lidl are organising around the country in November, because those are aimed, they're not going to be long, they're going to be 45 minutes maximum, tasting in the dark. So obviously in 45 minutes, you're not going to become wine experts overnight. But we're pretty confident that in that 45 minutes, we will show that less expensive wines can be just as good as the bigger brand names. And we'll also, we think, help people understand a little bit more about their own taste in wine, their own palate. And I think that will help it make it easier for them to make an informed choice in future.
Richard, some terrific advice there. Obviously, I need to say that other supermarkets are available just for the legal side of things there, which is important. But to appreciate the connection with the Master of Wine from Lidl. Where can people actually go to, Richard, to find out further information online? Is it just type in Lidl and that'll ring up everything?
It might do, but it would be safer to go to Eventbrite, which I think everyone is familiar with. And on Eventbrite, search for Chateau Noir. Chateau as in French castles, Noir, N-O-I-R, Chateau Noir. And then the three venues in London, Liverpool and Glasgow will come up, and you're able to register there. Tickets just £5, and all proceeds will go to the NSPCC, which is Lidl's preferred charity.
20 million. 20 million is a significant number by anybody's reckoning. And when you realise that, according to a new poll released by the charity Marie Curie, that approximately 20 million of us in the UK, that's just over a third of us, don't know what end-of-life support and services are currently available. So let's try and put this right, even though you might well say, I don't want to talk about my rough guides to the end of life. Well, let's just be brave and see what can conceivably happen over the next few moments when we speak to Matt Williams, Head of Information and Support at Marie Curie Storytellers. So, Matt, in terms of that whole side of things there, I mean, I've talked about the Marie Curie charity. It does some excellent work, outstanding work in so many ways. Were you surprised by this report?
Thanks, Alex. I think it is surprising when you hear the scale of that number, 20 million people. But at the same time, as you said, actually, it's still a taboo subject, isn't it? Speaking about dying and death. And it's something that quite a lot of us, as the figure suggests, aren't very comfortable with. So I guess in that respect, it isn't actually that surprising, but it's so important. We've all experienced bereavement, I'm sure, at some point. And not knowing what that person wanted or what their wishes were could be very, very difficult difficult for the family involved. And even, you know, before death, not having that support around a family can make a death absolutely, you know, even worse than it could be. So we want to change that. We want to make sure that people understand what options are out there, provide information and support to those people throughout the UK who are dealing with the most difficult situation, whatever the illness.
It is a certainty, of course, that the only certainty in life is its ending. And clearly, in terms of that, why the collaboration with a Rough Guide? Because, I mean, most people are used to Rough Guide in terms of travel and issues. Is this a travel journey to the undiscovered country, to quote Shakespeare?
Well, it's a very good point. Yeah, I think a lot of people tell us it's a journey of some sort, going through a terminal illness and having end of life care and palliative care. And as you said, Rough Guides are, you know, one of the best known travel companies out there. And it strikes me that when you enter this world, lots of new parents will receive lots of books, a kind of one stop shop books about what to expect. But when we leave the world, there isn't that sort of information out there, certainly not on the scale that we need it. And organisations like Marie Curie have great information and support resources out there, and you'll find them on websites and, you know, GP surgeries. But actually, for the general public, they may not see those, and they may not know where to turn. So the collaboration with Rough Guides is to really put all of that in one place, in one straightforward guidebook that has information about all manners of end-of-life care and end-of-life support, whether it's around the legalities, you know, around making wills and things like that. Other things to consider, like planning funerals and leaving memories, and what care options are out there as well. So it'll hopefully really inform people, you know, and take away some of that fear that probably a lot of people have right now.
Marie Curie, of course, inevitably associated with cancer care and so on, but this is something which presumably also refers to, as you said, Matt, other serious illnesses, other life-threatening, life-ending illnesses and so on. And it's probably important to realize that nobody knows how they're going to go from that line. But, you know, there is at least this option that's actually there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Marie Curie, as you said, we're probably best known as a cancer support charity, but we're actually there for anyone at end of life now. You know, we've been around for 75 years. We started in the same year as the NHS, and we can care for people who have a terminal condition or an illness or disease they're likely to die from, whether that's dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's motor neuron disease or anything else. We're there for people beyond cancer. Obviously, cancer is still making up a huge amount of the people that we support. But as you said, there can be all manner of illnesses and diseases out there, and people aren't really sure where to turn. So, you know, we work really closely with the NHS and lots of other organisations as well to provide that support UK-wide, whether it's in one of our 9 hospices or whether it's in the community and in people's homes as well.
Often said that it's hardest on those left behind in issues of loss and death and so on. And I was intrigued to see that 50% of people who were surveyed admitted they had given little thought to planning ahead if either they or a loved one were to receive a terminal diagnosis. Again, is this just something that we prefer just literally not to even let it enter the conversation?
I think it is the case, unfortunately. And again, I'm sure we've all got experience of that. I certainly have, on a personal basis, where you're not quite sure about people's wishes after they die and what they maybe wanted to do. And, you know, even things around planning a funeral, you know, what songs would they want or what service would they want, things like that. And having those conversations earlier on can really help family members that are left behind. And it can comfort them a little bit to know that they did what you wanted, you know, they followed your wishes, whatever they may be, and that can be a real comfort to those people. And obviously, there are lots of organisations out there as well, including Marie Curie, that can offer support to people who are bereaved, and that's really important too. You know, that it's so important to speak about how you're feeling and reach out for that extra support.
The Rough Guide to the End of Life has been released. It is free. How can people get hold of a copy of the text itself, Matthew?
So we'd encourage anyone who would like to download a copy, as you said, completely free of charge, to visit our website, mariecurie.org.uk, and you'll see a link on there. There's great information on the website as well, but I think the Rough Guide is a really great way of having that, as I said, one-stop shop of information from start to finish around end of life and palliative care and terminal illness.
Matt Williams, Head of Information and Support at Marie Curie. Many thanks, and keep on keeping on, Matt.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Alex. Take care.
Well, that's it then. I suppose for another 4 years until we go down to Australia for the next Rugby World Cup. Natasha, so close, so near, but yet so far away. 1 point. 1 point. And obviously horse with all sorts of things exactly. Owen Farrell kicked every one of ours. Is it a case of devastation in Australia, or is it a case of, well, at least we're going to have a Southern Hemisphere country that'll win the Rugby World Cup?
I mean, in terms of Australia in general, I don't think they're devastated. I think they're probably pretty happy that we've been knocked out. Personally, yes, it's sad. But honestly, going into this, did I think we were going to win it? Probably not, given the state of affairs. But it will be interesting to see who will come out of that final on top. My father-in-law was at the semi-finals in Paris. He said it was bitterly cold, and it was actually not the greatest match to kind of be in the crowd of, because it was a frustrating game. He said he felt like it was a frustrating game, and so being in the stands, you could feel that frustration. So it's interesting hearing from people that were there, obviously watching it. Obviously, it's frustrating as well. But yeah. It is what it is. Then we shall see who wins.
Well, again, what's your prediction then for the South Africa versus New Zealand game? I mean, hopefully if there's any justice in the world, it will be a New Zealand win, won't it?
I mean, yes, but I'm also married to a big South Africa fan. So, so I know in terms of the sake of peace on that side of the family, it'd probably be better if South Africa do win.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, we'll just have to wait and see in terms of what happens with respect to their choice, etc. Of course, a deeply sad weekend, not only because of the Rugby World Cup, but also we've lost a true great, a true legend, who probably was way ahead of his time in so many ways. Of course, 86 years of age, and although he's a Manchester United person, and obviously I'm more a Man City player, one cannot but acknowledge the sheer joy and wonderment and humbleness that Bobby Charlton actually gave to the world pre-internet age, pre-other sort of areas. Clearly one of the most prolific and indeed profound citizens of Great Britain. I already saw one obituary which said, somehow a little bit of Britain has died today. Certainly a big chunk of England has actually died with the passing of Sir Bobby Charlton. Doubtless Sir Bobby was a fixture, I would have thought, in your days as international Who's Who editor.
Well, indeed, he was in, as all the top people in, well, I like to think, we certainly tried, in top fields was in, yes, indeed.
Yeah, again, Sarah Huntley, any thoughts on the passing of Sir Bobby, or was it a case of, well, you know, I'm just coming to grips with Wales' hopeless performance in the Rugby World Cup?
Well, I haven't spoken to any of the Welsh yet, because I'm down in Cornwall on my own at the moment. But actually, I worked with Sir Bobby Charlton on a commercial back in the day, and it was for NatWest. And it's going to show how old I am, everyone, because the whole thing about it was my bank's open on a Saturday. And what they did was they got Bobby Charlton. It was filmed in Blackpool, and it was me with my boyfriend, or him, this actor, nice guy, and he's going along the beach and he's run out of money for this date that he's on in Blackpool, and Bobby Charlton goes by and he thinks, what? He said, you couldn't lend me a fiver, could you? And he says, oh, well, yes, here you go, you know, because I'm on this date. And he goes, mine's open on a Saturday. And that was the start of banks being open on a Saturday for NatWest. But he, as you say, I just was amazed at how low-key, humble, and very nice he was.
Yeah, I mean, we see a great deal with footballers these days who are basically egos enter the room long before they ever do. But so, I mean, you say that in any country of the world, just say the words Bobby Charlton, and that was the English, the translation was there. Fia, in the Netherlands, Bobby Charlton, carry any resonance with you?
No, it doesn't. I'm also not a big football fan, so maybe that is also part of the reason why I don't know him. But I mean, it's a lovely story that you said, Sara. So he must be a very
I wasn't a great football person at all, like you. And then when I told people, I went, Bobby Charlton, crikey, that's amazing company. And I went, well, yes. And yeah, I've always been terribly proud of the fact that I've even met him. So yes. How old was he, Alex?
86. And again, sadly, that leaves only one of the England 66 World Cup teams still alive. That's the Jeff Hurst. Everybody else has actually gone into the great Wembley Stadium in the sky. And sadly, the vast majority of them have also gone with dementia, which is another sort of thing. Something which I would have thought would be a much better form of narrative than indeed one of Richard's movie selections today, which, as I've already said to Natasha, I would say do not watch this at all. It's full of the F-bomb in French, admittedly, but there's so much bad language and so much appalling activity that goes on there. It purports to be part of a true story. Frankly, I think you'd do better to actually sort of go to church and say some prayers rather than subject yourself to this horrendous diatribe. In fact, actually, Richard, I'm going further. It got me thinking we should bring the Hays Code back and actually have the Hays Code into systems to prevent any of this stuff from infecting and polluting the era. But let's not talk about that. Let's talk about Martin Scorsese's latest opus, his last collaboration, sadly, with another person who's left us, Robbie Robertson, ace musician and of course collaborator with the band. This one, of course, you've got Lily Gladstone, you've got Robert De Niro, Leonardo DiCaprio, Jesse Plemons, of course. It again shows man, emphasis on the whole notion of his inhumanity to fellow citizens of the planet, with of course Killers of the Flower Moon.
Indeed, yes, and it's a very, very powerful film. And I have to say, I'm very, very pleased looking at the initial, this is very early, the initial box office receipts, that it seems to be doing rather well. I mention this specifically because it's 3.5 hours long, and it is a challenge for any director to, and obviously Scorsese's got many admirers, to get audiences to a movie paced in this way. It's, I mean, he's a wonderfully idiosyncratic director, and I think if you look back at some of his movies, Goodfellas, Taxi Driver, The Age of Innocence, and perhaps the closest to the Killers of the Flower Moon is the silence about in the set of the 19th century about missionaries in Japan, which was also an idiosyncratic film, and I wonder whether it didn't obviously have much box office appeal. Now, this, of course, has two really big stars, plus Lily Gladstone, who's an absolute wonder. And from that point of view, I'm hoping it's going to do very, very well. We follow, after an initial scene of the Osage burying a ceremonial pipe there, afraid of losing their culture to the whites. And it's set in 1918 originally. Ernest Burkhardt, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, returns from World War One and he goes to visit his uncle William King Hale, played by Robert De Niro, a prominent businessman, you could say that again, and also a law enforcement officer in the Native American Osage Nation in Oklahoma, and also Burkhardt's brother Brian is there as well. And the Osage have become extremely wealthy. What has happened is that they've discovered oil, and the Flower Moon is a reference to the floral growth that occurs. It's a fabulous, you look at an extraordinary vistas of flowers from time to time on their lands. And most of the laws require them to have white, in inverted commas, guardians to manage their wealth. Observe how this is going to work out. Because firstly, Ernest works as a cab driver for King Hale, and he gives Molly, played by Lily Gladstone, a ride. A romance transpires, and also, Hale and Ernest are waiting to exploit. They're waiting to exploit the wealth of this particular family, because Molly has two sisters. and her three sisters and also her mother. Now, if for some reason they were all to disappear, who would get the wealth and how could that be channeled back, obviously, to King Hale? But Ernest is somewhat of a pawn. He's very idiotic. He's very, very impetuous as a character. He's not especially bright in the top story and also easily influenced. So we see Molly's sister Anna, while she carries a gun, she's an alcoholic, she gets murdered. Her sister Minnie dies from a wasting disease. And in fact, that variety of murders, isn't it extraordinary, just so happened to be individuals from the Osage tribe time and time and time again, and no one takes any notice or seems to be concerned about it. There's Henry Roan, who happens to be Molly's first husband. Now, could that mean that he would have rights if, for example, she were to inherit vast sums? You can see where all this is obviously heading. And also the fact that Molly starts getting insulin injections. Could there be a little more than insulin in those injections? It is a very, very sobering film. It's not only institutional racism that we're seeing, it's also the most extraordinary exploitation. It's a terrifying picture. You lose your land, you lose your rights, and then you get murdered. And also there's a brief footage of the exploitation of African-Americans in the Tulsa riots that we see. But essentially, we're concentrating, and this is where the film works so well, on specific characters who we get to know. Robert De Niro's King Hale is an amazing performance. It's a portrait in the most culpable dishonesty and murderous dishonesty, to the extent where it has been said, without mentioning any British individuals who might happen to have been in politics, it has been said sometimes that individuals who are complete crooks can believe their own lies. De Niro's performance is so convincing that you'd almost believe that, I mean, he believes himself to be a friend of the Osage. He's quite prepared to ruthlessly murder and use any means. There are a whole variety of individuals who can be hired for this purpose. DiCaprio is fascinating because, looking at his previous performances, I don't think that we've seen somebody as conflicted as this. He's easily influenced. He has children. What would happen if something happened to one of them? And how does he respond? How is he manipulated? How willingly, to a certain extent, and yet his feelings for Molly are undoubtedly, they exist. It is an intriguing portrayal by DiCaprio, and I'm thinking he's probably going to end up with an Oscar for this role, because it is very, very fine. And Lily Gladstone, a beautifully nuanced performance as Molly. Indeed, she's really superb. And the supporting cast in this movie, flawless, absolutely excellent. Jesse Plemons, yes, plays the FBI's early days. Molly, despite her ill health, travels to Washington and asks the president to help because all these murders are being completely are unsolved, and it's perfectly obvious the exploitation that's going on. And that means that the embryonic Federal Bureau of Investigations start looking into what are obviously murders, and subsequently you will find, no spoilers, but we'll find out what happens. Visually very, very strong, and not to the extent where it's in any way intrusive. Similarly, the music backs this up, and the big argument may occur over its length. Could it have been, and I say this for box office reasons, simply because if you ask people to sit through 3.5 hours, and that could be off-putting, it can be, it is challenging. It's a very clever ending, no spoilers at all of what that ending involves. It could involve
the radio show, Richard. Ends of the radio show.
Please don't give spoilers. I really want to see this one. No, I don't want any spoilers, please.
I'm not. Alex, that's outrageous. You really, really, really should
doing
not.
A radio show.
And I'm not allowing you to spoil it. It's a very hard-hitting movie. Occasionally I'd fault its continuity, but the photography, the music, all of this, very, very fine, and a truly amazing performance by DiCaprio and also by Robert De Niro and by Lily Gladstone. So expect Oscars. It's got, of course, Oppenheimer to fight, and of course, don't let's forget Barbie, but it's not likely that that is going to be in direct competition. Except that anything at the Oscars, of course, is. So this is fascinating. It's important for cinema that films of the sort are made. And Scorsese, given his history, it's fascinating to see what he takes on and what he's taking on next, which I'm longing to see as well.
Natasha, given that Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro are both 80 years of age, and you've just celebrated a birthday, which also gets you closer to 80 these days. So any thoughts for yourself, Natasha, in terms of would you be able to give up 3.5 hours of your time to sit through this one?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Since the minute I first saw the release trailer, I really, 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 really want to see this movie. I think it's going to be an exceptional piece of cinema, and I'm really excited to see how it plays out. And I genuinely don't know how it's going to end, so don't want any spoilers in that way.
Ends with a radio show. Fear.
Oh, no, Alex, you really, really, really ought to restrain yourself on this sort of thing. Nobody, luckily, has any idea what you're talking about.
Well, you have if you've seen the movie.
No.
Any thoughts from yourself? Is this one for yourself in the Netherlands?
I already know I'm going to watch it next week. So, I mean, that says something. I completely agree with Natasha. I don't want to hear any spoilers because I'm very excited to watch this movie.
And Sarah Huntley, one for you?
Alex, I'm echoing what everybody else is saying. Yes.
Well, one that I would say definitely should not be for anybody, really, is The Stronghold. I actually gave up on this one. I did actually return to it at the end, but I gave up on it at the moment where a child was actually swearing like a trooper in the back of a police car with a whole range of other systems. And I just thought, this is saying nothing for the human condition. It's saying a dreadful situation about the situation in France. It's dealing with the drug problem in Marseille in a way which just simply seems to glorify it. Frankly, The Stronghold. Richard, I was shocked. I don't know what's going through your mind, but to select this one, unbelievable.
Firstly, Alex, I say that I had no idea what I was going to see. I was choosing a particular, and as I point out, I've had the odd hiccup, so I was choosing something that looked interesting, and also it was up for 7 César Awards in France. May I just point that out to you? So, in fact, it's a film to be regarded, I thought, rather highly. It's set in 2012. 3 cops we meet Greg, played by Gilles Lelouch. We meet Antoine, and played by Francois Civil, and Yass, played by Karim Leclerc. Now, 18 actually went down, and indeed this was something of a course célèbre. The idea was to bust the distribution centre in Marseille, which is synonymous with crime, of drugs. Now, and the fact that it was up for so many awards shows that others also thought that this was a very entertaining film because its strength, I thought, lies in its ambiguity. To bust a center for drugs, there's no question that the Greg and his team, and I leave the language aside, you've dealt with it, but it didn't worry me in the sense that some people talk like this all the time. And from that point of view, I don't see the...
Richard? Why do they do that? Because they see this put forward as a Hollywood norm. This is ridiculous. Standards are slipping. We started off today by talking about Bobby Charlton. He would probably rarely have uttered a profanity. Here we are somewhere down the line, and we've got a huge challenge. Movies like this do not help raise the human condition. End of.
No. I first agree. Secondly, you mentioned bringing back the Hays Code. Just to remind everyone what the Hays Code is, I gather Alex wouldn't have, for example, if you were on a bed in a bed with someone else, two of your feet would naturally be on the floor, and what you'd be doing, what you'd be saying, how you'd be moving, all of this was, in fact, and it lasted for decades, a way that the religious right and others managed to control Hollywood, because, in fact, until The Graduate, which meant the Hays Code collapsed, because there was nothing, no legal way that it should be necessarily prolonged, and it had a vice-like grip on cinema and what you could show, certainly with reference to anything intimacy. I mean, not to mention anything to do with language. I mean, you're a Puritan at heart, Alex, to suggest that, because the Hays Code was monstrous. It basically, it originated in the 1920s. It actually, I think it was in the early 1930s. Topless dancers and Cecil B. DeMille movie and this sort of thing was offending people in those days. Yes, there are extremes we've had, but the cinema is there to explore the human condition in all its aspects, and it's up to you to choose what you see and what you don't see. Here we get a team of officers who are charged with stealing drugs, which in fact they pass to an informant to bust this crime syndicate. And it what I thought worked in this movie, it's based in real events. The arrests occurred, and in fact the controversy about this movie wasn't what you were talking about. The controversy about this movie is that there is still investigations going on with reference to this particular case, so it's a very odd time to make it. But you've got a top class actor, Gilles Lelouch, playing Greg. Now, Greg is a violent character and he doesn't belong in any police force. But on the other hand, you could argue the contrary, that in fact, you've got Marseille's crime ridden.
Richard, do you see any positive representations of non-white people in this whole thing? Any?
I didn't look at it from that point
you
of view.
You see none. Absolutely zero.
Well, it depends by the you use the term non-white. I mean,
black actors, Richard. Black actors portrayed as animalistic and savage individuals across the base. It was there horrendous.
This was not, no one, as far as I know, made this, because I've been reading about this and the response, as far as I know, no one read that point. The point, as I say, there was the point that this is still under investigation. Yes, you could argue it glorifies cops who resort, shall we say, to certain ambiguities of behaviour are obvious in the way, as I say, Greg, played by Gilles Lelouch, very, very powerful performance. That's a superb...
What would stop the drug problem, Richard? Don't use drugs. End of.
Well, firstly, they may well legalise drugs here, and in America, this is another topic. But if you look at... There's a wonderful scene where Greg, who is an intensely violent, short-tempered individual, where he argues with a bureaucrat who's beginning the process of sending him down. They all get imprisoned because drugs are found on them. They claim that the drugs were used to pay an informant, from that informant, they were heroically praised for busting the syndicate. I mean, director and co-writer Cedric Jimenez certainly made a controversial movie, and the lines are very blurred between the behaviour of cops. They constantly, I mean, they are not particularly pleasant individuals, you could certainly argue, family lives or not. I mean, they go, there are problems with the people who use drugs and are involved in the drug trade. The moment they see a cop, they behave in weird ways. And what you have also are the cops dying to, especially Greg, fight with them. There's no question you've got this violence and the blurring.
Richard, as somebody who actually a year ago actually was a victim of violence, I take great exception to that. Because actually, when somebody does attack you and force you down through a whole thing, this is not a pleasant experience. To see it glorified on the screen, I find deeply offensive. And I say no more.
Well, I thought that, as I say, the film has been very highly praised and very good performances. So we've got Adele Exarchopoulos, who we saw in an early movie. Very, very, it's an interesting insight I thought it gave into the lives of policemen who live very close to the edge. And yes, frankly, some of them enjoy it and some of them it is extremely, extremely destructive. Blue is the Warmest Colour was Adele's last film, which was a well-known film. No, I know that you had a terrible experience, Alex, but I didn't think that you'd object to this film in this way.
I just think it fuels the situation when people actually come out of this movie and they shouldn't be entertained. Natasha, what did you make of it?
Sorry, can I just make the point? Very good use of music, very good use of visuals, both of them remarkable.
I thought that it was a very interesting reflection on the status quo you see going on in France right now. I do have relatives in France, and unfortunately, there is a lot of unrest, and there has always been a lot of unrest. I mean, you think of the Republic and the revolutions and various things, but there is that unrest between the mistrust of the police and the general people feeling like they're not being protected by the police, they're not being represented by the police. And I thought that that sort of exploration was interesting in the movie. I liked the way that you sort of got a bit of the everyday camaraderie build up beforehand, before you got straight to the bust. I did feel like it did drag a little bit in terms of its pace at the start there with that. My main complaint would be my main complaint is the camera work. I found that there was a lot of body shots where the sort of the camera was mounted on a person as they're sort of chasing someone as they're running. And I found that very disorientating when the sort of the screen's going like all over the place. I got a little bit seasick watching those scenes and I sort of had to pause a minute. But apart from that, I thought the story was actually very interesting. It did hook me in. I didn't necessarily have the issues with it that maybe you did, Alex, from a personal perspective, but that again, obviously is not my personal. You know, I've not been in that position, so I can only comment from the position that I'm coming from at it. So yeah, from a personal perspective, in terms of like the family that is in France and the political and social unrest there, I found it very interesting reflection of that. And again, that whole throwing your scapegoats under the bus, throwing your good men under the bus by these superiors for the sake of the political standing and all of that, I thought that was a very interesting twist in all of it. It's one that's been done many times. We do see a lot of films where, you know, the heroes of the hour get scapegoated. But obviously this is much more of a realistic reflection of that because it's based on a true events, right? Or you would hope. It claims to be based on true events, so you would hope that it's based on true events. Generally, yeah, I did enjoy this movie. I don't know if enjoy is the right word. It gripped me. I don't know if I came away from it thinking it was a pleasant movie, because it's not a particularly pleasant movie. But it's a movie that makes you think, and I think that it is a movie that does reflect certain political situations in a kind of a journalistic kind of way in some regard. So because of that, I am going to go to an 8. My complaints with it being mainly the camera work and also sort of a couple of pacing errors. The second half of the movie, the pacing is superb. The first half, whilst I get it's relevant in terms of getting you to care about the characters, I did feel I was sort of get set at that half an hour point mark going, is it what's happening? When are we going to actually get into something? So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree, by the way, but Alex, you forgot to ask me to score it. I would also score it an 8.
Yes, I thought you might, Richard. Personally, I give it a 2 out of 10, and that's for House of the Rising Sun. Sarah Huntley, is this one for you, or should we expect better from representation of the cinema?
Well, it's difficult for me to comment, Alex, because I haven't seen it. Personally, I would say, at the moment, I can see everybody's point of view on this one. If I had the time to go to the cinema twice in a week, say, I probably wouldn't go and see this and something similar, because I think there's so much part for me, cinema is about escaping to a different place. So sometimes, as we were talking about the film that's been made about,
Osage.
Ukraine, that I feel morally I should go and see to, and I pretty much believe what they've come up with is what's happening, or what happened. So I would, but yes, it's, I think I am aware of overloading my brain with things that put me in a bad place. So if it was going to put me in a bad place twice in that week, I wouldn't go and see it. I'm intrigued to see it now because people have got different views on it. And I don't want to comment on it because I don't know how that scene is shot and what the outcome for those people is. But I do take on board when you've had a very personal experience with something, that it makes you approach and see the thing in a different way, perhaps.
I just like to feel that we could at least have one redeeming character, and probably the sole redeeming character in here is actually the female drug dealer, and she doesn't come to a good end either. However, Fia, from your own perspective, any line that you're heading for, or is this a case of, well, thank heavens in Holland we don't have these issues?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure if we have those issues, but if we don't, I'm very happy that we don't. But I also haven't seen a movie like Sarah. But I'm also, the sun. Oh, but I'm
sun
very,
always shines in Holland. It's an important thing.
Yeah, no, but I'm actually quite interested to watch the movie now because, I mean, there are so many different scores here and so many different opinions about the movie that it makes me interested in how will I react to this movie? So I'm going to come back to this.
Very good. Excellent. Okay. That pretty much wraps up this particular time. We don't have time, Richard, sadly. You spent too much time on the negativity to go into your portraiture. And I notice you've still stepped away from a very highly popular movie in its own way, The Sound of Silence. Is that ever going to get unpicked by yourself, or are you just going to leave that to one side?
Well, I'll decide in the next week, Alex. I'll decide in the next week. Okay. But let's deal with the portraiture in Franz Hals next week.
There you go. Fia van den Berger, Richard Fitzwilliams. Yes. Hopefully we'll be suffering a defeat by New Zealand next week. I know it's not just once, it's twice. New Zealand.
Oh, well, Alex, incidentally, I didn't, so sorry to interrupt, I didn't score the killers of, I didn't
You'll
score.
Give it a 10, Richard, I know this, so it's okay. Possibly a 9.5, but likely to be a 10.
Yes, exactly. It was actually 9. I was just a little trimming, perhaps. Yes, but wonderful, wonderful. Yeah,
there we are. As I say, South Africa not only beating us in the cricket, but also in the rugby as well. Frankly, it shows that it's been an unfair time. To Natasha Want and to Fia van den Berger, to Richard Fitzwilliams and to Sarah Huntley, many thanks. And keep watching those movies, apart from maybe Stronghold.